Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The early 1990s were a particularly deadly time in Boston's history. As the crack epidemic swept through inner-city neighborhoods across the country, in Boston, gang violence raged out of control and the murder rate hit an all-time high.
Since then, homicides have come down dramatically. And over the years, there's been a lot of talk about the so-called Boston miracle. In fact, it wasn't a miracle. It was the result of a series of law enforcement and community-based strategies that helped reduce gang-related violence.
David Kennedy was among those who played a big role in designing what, back then, was a new response to urban violence called Operation Ceasefire. Kennedy is a largely self-taught criminologist whose strategy has been deployed in over 50 U.S. cities, in many cases with stunning success.
His new book is called Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. David Kennedy is a professor of criminal justice at John Jay College and the director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control in New York, and he joins us here in the studio. And David Kennedy, welcome. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Great to be back.
So at its core, there's so much to talk about here, but I want to just start and talk about what Operation Ceasefire is. At its core, it seems like such a simple idea. Law enforcement, in cooperation with community leaders, say to gang members, there's a way out of this, right?
Actually, before that, they say something even simpler, which is don't hurt people. It's very, very basic.
Don't hurt people, and this isn't a negotiation, right?
That's right. So it is fantastically simple, which has been part of our issue over the now decades, is getting people to believe that something this simple could actually be as important and effective as it is. So here's how it works. In any city where there's a serious violence problem, it's being driven by a tiny, 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 very identifiable population. So we do this work in cities all over the country, as you've just said, and no matter where you go, it's something like 0.5% of the city's population. They are involved in gangs and drug crews and sets, and they're active in street drug markets. They are very easy to identify at the street level. And if you affect their behavior, you have a massively disproportionate impact on the violence of an entire city. And it turns out there is this kind of stupid, simple way of affecting their behavior. You identify them. You figure out ways to talk to them. We literally called them in at the beginning in Boston. All these groups have people on probation or parole, so you can mandate their appearance as a condition of their court supervision. They walk into the room and they see a new partnership. They see assembled law enforcement, police, prosecutors, feds, everybody. They see people they respect in their community, the neighborhood elders, the older, wiser ex-offenders, the mothers of murdered children. And they see people who can help them, various kinds of service providers and outreach workers and that kind of thing. And that partnership says to them, this has got to stop. Your community can't stand it. We want to save your life. We want to help you. You have to stop hurting people. Here's how you can get help. And law enforcement will follow the violence from now on. It will go to the gangs and the groups that are hurting people, and it will pay systematic attention to them. And if you want that kind of attention, let one of your boys shoot somebody. And when that partnership systematically follows up on all those promises, you get this outsized result.
So the idea at the time, I mean, 15, 20 years ago, it must have sounded sort of revolutionary because there was such a focus on punishment, on locking people up. There still is, actually.
There still is.
Why did that approach, the threat of going to jail, fail to stop the killings back in the 90s, for example?
Well, the most important reason is that, again, a hugely disproportionate amount of the violence is driven by the fact that these guys in the street life are so terrified. And they are absolutely right to be terrified. They are carrying guns. They are joining gangs. They are acting violently because the rest of us are not keeping them safe, and they are at astronomical risk. So the national homicide rate right now has edged down to about 4 per 100,000, as criminologists keep the numbers. So every year, four dead bodies per 100,000 population killed by homicide. If you're a young black man in many of these neighborhoods, your homicide risk every year is over 500 per 100,000. Hmm. It's just shocking. And if you're in this gang life, it can go up as high as 3,000 per 100,000. One in 30 of you gets murdered every single year. And the reason they don't care about going to prison is because they're going to carry a gun today, because if they don't, they think they're going to get killed.
In your book, Don't Shoot, you give a lot of credit to some key players, one in particular in the Boston Police Department, chief among them Paul Joyce, who back then was a detective running the department's youth violence strike force. What did you learn from Paul Joyce?
Everything. Just about literally. You know, I tell this story, and I think people don't believe it. I think people think that not just me, but the rest of the Harvard team that was involved in this is being overly modest or something like that. Not so. It is literally the fact that the very first day we met with Paul Joyce, Detective Sergeant Paul Joyce, and his people at Special Ops Command on Warren Street in Roxbury, January 1995, he and they told us everything we needed to know to understand and come at this problem in an entirely new way, because they already understood what was going on. They knew from their own work and street wisdom.
So among the things they knew, for example, they knew who was doing the shooting. They knew who were the key gangbangers. They knew who the bad players were.
Yep, they knew the gangs. They knew the drug crews. They knew who was in them. They knew who was important in them. They knew the beefs and vendettas that were mostly driving the violence. They understood the street code that was driving the violence. They understood all of that.
And this sort of shocked you that they had this wisdom, didn't it?
It didn't shock me. I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, I honestly could not believe that what they were telling me was right, because it was so completely at odds with the scholarship and the rest of the conversation on the issue at the time. And thank God we listened, because literally everything that's happened in this area since then has stemmed from what they taught us.
So how did you put that into practice? How did the community put that into practice in such a way that the crime rate did come down?
They taught us that too. So it wasn't just the sort of description and diagnosis they taught us. They modeled for us what became Operation Ceasefire. So at the time, they kept telling us about something they called Scrap Iron, which was an operation they'd run on Wendover Street in Dorchester. And it had literally ended with these gang kids going across the city and handing their guns over at Special Ops on Warren Street, shopping bags full of handguns. And it took 6-8 months for us to understand what they'd done that made that happen. But when we did, it was the roots of Ceasefire, because what they had done was say to that crew, we are going to be paying all kinds of special attention to you because you are shooting. We will take advantage of the crimes you're committing. We're here because of the violence, but we will pay attention to drug sales and drug use and outstanding warrants and open cases and all that kind of stuff. And if you want things to go back to normal, not for us to ignore you, but if you want it to go back to the way it was with just standard attention from us, put your guns down. And when we understood that, that was what we all then built into Ceasefire.
Listeners, we're talking about urban violence, what can be done about it. What was done about it here in Boston with David Kennedy? Is the so-called Boston miracle still with us, or is it time for another? You can give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. David Kennedy, I just want to remind listeners who may not recall that history or may not have been here. 1990, there were 152 murders in Boston. That was historically high. By 1999, a few years after the implementation of Operation Ceasefire and a bunch of other measures, 31 murders, not one of them a juvenile. So here's my question. since then, the murder rate has crept up. 50 murders in 2009, I believe about the same last year. This year to date, there have been 51 murders, including two just this week. So does that suggest to you that we're slipping a little bit here?
It's actually better than it was at one point. Mm. So the history of Boston on this is now well known, both in and outside the city, and it leads to very clear lessons. And Boston's gotten a lot of attention around what I'm about to describe, but it's important to say that Boston's not alone here. The national history of this work is that in many places it has been put in place. It has not been made a central part of the city's approach to these issues. It's been a kind of side project. Mm. It has worked dramatically well, and because the various cities have not taken it as seriously as we now see them taking it, it has fallen apart. And that's what happened in Boston. Mm. So ceasefire was in place until about 2000. The city let it slip away. The killing came back in a steady and ultimately quite dramatic fashion. And under the new police commissioner, Ed Davis, it is being put back. And in fact, it's being put back in a way that's more woven into the standard operating procedure and the core philosophy of the Boston Police Department than it ever was. Hmm. He is building it into his command staff. He's building it into the districts, into the geographic commands. My old colleague, who was a central part of launching ceasefire here, Anthony Braga, is actually a civilian member of the commissioner's command staff. And we have learned the hard way that just with, you know, as with your own kids, if you say something and you don't do it, you lose them. Mm-hmm. And Boston not only has to go back to being as effective as it once was, but it has to deal with the fact that the streets know that it came, it went, it's back. It's an uphill process to get them to take it seriously.
Let me ask you about the rate of sort of overall violent crime. Generally, we've seen the last few years, it's going down in many categories nationally, in the big categories. Things seem to be getting better. But does that mean they're getting better in most inner city neighborhoods?
It absolutely does not. And so the national numbers are real, and the national sense of good news about that is also in a core way real, but it's also tremendously misleading. So the national homicide rate hit in the bad crack years about 10 per 100,000. It's now down to something like 4 per 100,000, but that's the national rate. And one of my very good friends, John Clofus, who teaches at the Rochester Institute of Technology, likes to say, nobody lives in the nation. We live in neighborhoods. Mm. And he's absolutely right. You don't care what the national cancer rate is if you're in the middle of a cancer cluster and mm-hmm. everybody on your block's dying. And that's the way this works. So the homicide rate in especially poor black neighborhoods, especially ones with a, you know, an intergenerational history of neglect and oppression, remains extraordinarily high. The national homicide rate for black men is over 100 per 100,000. Hmm. And then in particular neighborhoods, it can reach 5-6 times that, to the extent that young men in some particularly dangerous neighborhoods are dying at a rate of one in 200 every year. It's appalling.
And so put that in, I mean, is there some way to explain what that means in actual numbers? Every year, numbers dying.
Yeah, so there is. And I think if ordinary Americans knew this, they would, this shocks the conscience. So here's one equivalency, and that is that we just observe the 10-year anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks. The young black male death count every single year is about the same nationally as the World Trade Center death count.
Almost, each year.
Almost 3,000 people every single year.
We're talking to David Kennedy. He's the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. You can join the conversation if you've got questions for David Kennedy about the Boston Miracle, about what needs to happen in Boston to bring the murder rate down even lower. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let me introduce James Dauphine. He's director of programs at the Ella J. Baker House in Dorchester. He's in the streets working with kids at risk, trying to convince as many of them as he can to get out of the violence game. And James, welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you back.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. Very well. James, you've been listening to this conversation. I'm just wondering what you're seeing on the street level. How has the approach to confronting the kind of violence that is out there changed over the years? And when you hear David Kennedy talk about Operation Ceasefire, does that still make sense to you? Is it still current today?
Some aspects of it is current, but you talk about a paradigm shift. So at the time, we had a lot of drugs. The economy was probably a little bit better. Now you're watching a lot of things that's going on that has a lot of it that has nothing to do with gangs. It has a lot to do with people who ain't got enough money, you know. Like I spoke earlier, I spoke to you and a couple other people about there seems to be more stick-up crews than there are drug dealers. So you got people who are robbing people. You know, and sometimes it ends up in extreme violence, but and they're doing, you know, home invasions, kidnappings, and this thing is going on all over the country. You're talking about Philly, Chicago, Detroit, Miami, ATL. This is common. This is all across. Everybody I speak to, all these states, all these cities I visited, same thing. Some of this stuff is under the radar. It has been public because it probably would have been like, it probably would have scared everybody to death. But there's some of the stuff that's been going on in Boston for the last few years, and it hasn't really shaken the masses as much. But for the kids on the street, it's common now. This is how we get down.
Well, James, let me put this to David Kennedy. It sounds like, David, that James is describing almost a sort of less organization around the criminality. I mean, when the gangs were focused on a drug trade, there was a certain logic behind the violence. Are we seeing a shift, or how do you describe the shift that James is possibly alluding to there?
So he's describing something that he's exactly right. We're seeing it all over the country. What you just said is the way we think about this, and with no disrespect, it's just not right.
So
the idea that this used to be more organized and more purposeful and more about the drug trade just turned out never to be right. And it's one of the things that Paul Joyce and his people taught us at the very beginning, that, and again, this first day in January, one of the many, many unbelievable things that they told us that they turned out to be right about was basically they're all drug crews, everybody's selling drugs, and hardly any of the violence is about drugs. And that turned out to be right. It's respect, it's disrespect, it's back and forth vendetta, it's boy-girl stuff. It was never as purposeful as people thought it was. And what James is describing is definitely an evolution in the street scene. The stick-up boys, the stick-up crews, the home invasion crews, he's right, they're everywhere. It's particularly toxic, but it also turns out to be something that you can deal with in much the same way.
James, does that sound right to you? I mean, in terms of the approach, in other words, can you imagine a scenario where you can identify the troublemakers in your community and get them in a room and say, shape up, stop doing this, we're going to give you a way out? I mean, that's, in a sense, that's the work you're doing, right?
Right. The difference between the stick-up crews and the gang thing, it's a little bit more criminal, you know? The gang factor could be because you have a dysfunctional family or because you're buddy-buddy, pal-pal. But the stick-up thing is a little more tricky because some of these stick-ups are like for big cash, you know, like $100,000, kidnappings for $200,000, you know what I mean? It's not like something you can just talk to, hey, guy, why don't you just be good? You stay here. Don't do that no more. But because the money is so abundant, it's not like something that we've seen before. It's always existed, but now it's more and more common. Like some of the murders over the year has been retaliations for these kinds of crimes, these mm-hmm. stick-ups. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? More than a gang sticker. I mean, it's not a gang murder. It was a stick-up retaliation murder. So it's a little bit different. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but it would have to be tweaked a little bit for it to work. Because now you're talking about working with shadow warriors and not apparent blocks.
People,
they go in and they go out. They go in and they go out. It's not like you could just go say, oh, they hang over there.
Yeah, right.
It's a different mentality. It's a different form of activity.
James Dauphine, stand by. David Kennedy, how has Operation Ceasefire evolved over the years? How is it evolving? And can you point to examples of how it's evolved and where it's having the most success these days?
Sure. So one is simply following the nature of the problem, as James has just described. You go where the violence is, and if you were dealing with one sort of crew and street scene at one point and that shifts, then you have to shift with it, and the record shows that you can do that. But the more important things, I think, are they've been realizing things that we weren't smart enough to recognize when Ceasefire was first developed now almost 20 years ago. At the time, it really was very law enforcement-centric. And since then, we have, I think, recognized two very important things. So one is the overwhelming power of the community engagement. Mm-hmm. So you do have whatever form it's taking, you do have the small hardcore. Almost everybody in the neighborhoods does not behave like this. The neighborhoods itself hate what's going on. And finding the right people, the folks who have standing in the eyes of that hardcore, and having them in their own voice and in their own way say, the community can't have this. The community needs this to stop. We're not the cops. We're not the outside. We're not the Chamber of Commerce. We're you, and we need this to stop. Turns out to be fantastically powerful. And the second, and this is what a lot of the book is about, and it's fascinating because I've been on tour for a while and nobody wants to talk about this, even though this is what a lot of the book is about, is, so if what I've just said is true, the community hates it, people will listen to the community, why isn't the community outspoken about this? And the answer is they are so angry at the rest of us that it shuts them down.
And I have a question about that, and our time is just about out, and it flows really well from what you just said. A little earlier, you said a whole World Trade Center full of young black males dying every year.
Yep.
Yet crime, fighting crime, not part of the political discourse.
Yep.
I certainly don't hear it out there among these characters running for president, for example. Why not?
Well, I'll quote one of my black partners who was asked this question behind closed doors, and what he said was, we're black, we're supposed to die. Nobody cares. And that's what the community experiences. I'm going to say in my own voice that they're pretty close to right. People don't care. And many in the community don't think that it's just that we don't care. The community thinks that we're making this happen. It's the conspiracy theories. It's the seamless integration with the real historical experience of especially African-American communities that they were deliberately oppressed under color of law. It's the idea that the cops and the CIA are bringing the drugs in. It's all of that.
David Kennedy, we have to end there, not on a hopeful note, but thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for the book. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
David Kennedy's new book is Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. James Dauphine, Director of Programs at the Ella J. Baker House in Dorchester, thank you as well.
All right.
And listeners, David Kennedy, along with U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, will be talking about crime in Boston tonight at a Ford Hall Forum event at 6:30 at the Modern Theater on Washington Street. It's free and open to the public. Stay with us. Up next, a live performance by Boston bluegrass favorites Crooked Still. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.